Welcome to Amplify, a podcast about the future of Europe, produced by the DCU Brexit Institute. We cover the latest developments in European integration, including the Conference on the Future of Europe and the Next Generation EU Post-Pandemic Recovery Plan. I'm your host, Ian Cooper. Today's episode is a conversation with Paul Dermeen, who is a referendaire at the European Court of Justice and author of a forthcoming book called The New Economic Governance of the Eurozone. Paul takes the long view of the Next Generation EU Recovery Plan, and he puts it into the context of how EU economic governance has evolved since the Eurozone crisis. Among other things, I ask him whether this is a Hamiltonian moment for the EU. My guest today is Paul Dermeen, and I'm going to get Paul to introduce himself because he's got a very interesting CV, and he can describe himself better than I can. Paul, go ahead. Welcome.
Thanks a lot, Ian. So my name is Paul Dermeen. I'm currently a referendaire at the Court of Justice of the European Union. But next to that, I'm also an academic. I've recently defended my PhD, which was jointly conducted at the universities of Maastricht and Leuven. That PhD was devoted to the new economic governance of the Eurozone, and its results will soon be published as a book with Cambridge University Press, which will come out next summer.
And the title of the book?
The title of the book is The New Economic Governance of the Eurozone, A Rule of Law Analysis.
Now, Paul, I would like to talk about the book in a few minutes, but this podcast is mainly about Next Generation EU and the Conference on the Future of Europe. So let's talk about those things first. Now, thinking about Next Generation EU, how would you describe what that is and how important it is?
Well, from a very practical perspective, Next Generation EU is truly the centerpiece of the EU's economic response to the COVID-19 crisis, to the pandemic, and the massive repercussions it had on European economies and societies. It's a recovery package, the core aim of which is to help European economies recover, and who also seeks to rebuild European economies to make them more resilient to future challenges. Now, from a broader perspective, Next Generation EU also stands as a structural project which has the potential to change the long-term trajectory of the European integration project. It's a very meaningful project. In many regards, it can represent a shift in the way the EU has operated in the field of economic policy, so it might very well come down in history as one of these important moments, one of these critical junctures in the history of European integration.
Can I just ask you, kind of, since you've been watching the evolution of economic governance for years, how surprised were you when they came up with this package in 2020. I mean, it was controversial and there was a lot of back and forth. There was this fight between the, those countries that wanted fiscal expansion and those, the kind of the so-called frugal countries that were resisting it. Were you surprised by the outcome?
I think most observers were very surprised because at first, during the very early stages of the crisis, it looked as if we were going to witness just a remake of the debates we had witnessed during the Eurozone crisis. So highly divisive discussions between the North and the South, between the creditor state and the debtor state. So we remember the very hard discussion in the Eurogroup in March, April 2020. And then I think the moment that shift occurred was really in May 2020, where there was this Franco-German deal on the recovery package and the move made by Chancellor Merkel to support such a package, because obviously Germany had always been the member states who was opposing deeper fiscal integration, increased financial solidarity. So that key moment in May 2020 was the moment when once it all suddenly became possible, and realistic that it would happen. So I was indeed surprised, because of course this idea of a central fiscal capacity, this idea of a capacity for the EU to borrow, to reinvest in European economies, is an old idea. It's already been discussed back in the days when the euro was created in Maastricht. It was discussed during the eurozone crisis, but the oppositions were always extremely stark, and it looked completely unfeasible. And then suddenly that pandemic occurred, and it totally changed the game. It totally changed the parameters of the discussion, and it all of a sudden made it possible.
I mean, this is a kind of a side question, but if you recall all the debates that were going on in the years leading up to 2020, the debate was mostly about whether there should be a fiscal capacity for the Eurozone specifically, as opposed to the European Union generally. And then it ended up being a fiscal capacity for the EU as a whole. Do you think that makes a difference, or would it, because your focus in your book is on the economic governance of the Eurozone in particular, right?
Yes, certainly. It's true that in the aftermath of the Eurozone crisis, in the aftermath of the sovereign debt crisis, we witnessed a strong process of differentiation with many mechanisms being set up at Eurozone level, which would only be focused on the Eurozone, most notably, of course, the creation of the European Stability Mechanism. But more generally, we also saw the creation of a Eurozone-specific legal, economic, and political regime. And that was a deep trend. And certainly, NGEU has had an impact on that evolution, in the sense that it made the Eurozone not less relevant, but less specific. And the choice was made to turn that recovery program into an EU-wide instrument. So certainly, differentiation is not over, but the divide between Eurozone and the EU as a whole is certainly less strong and less relevant from a political and from a legal perspective. So we'll have to see how this plays out on the long term, but certainly NGEU marks a bit of a shift in that regard. Mm-hmm.
And this is another side question, but do you think if Britain was still a member state of the European Union, that NGEU would have ever happened?
That's a highly hypothetical question that I'm not sure I'm really willing to answer. But no, certainly the fact that Brexit happened has made the Eurozone versus non-Eurozone divide less relevant, because we no longer have that major political player who is not part of the Eurozone. So the prospect of having the Eurozone and the EU fully overlap in the coming decades is no longer purely illusionary. It was illusionary until the UK was in, because it was clear that the UK would never join. Now it's a different story. So certainly Brexit had an impact in that regard, in the sense that the distinction and the differentiation lost a bit of its relevance.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's right. And I think that probably a lot of the reason that the pre-Brexit argument was about a fiscal capacity for the Eurozone in particular was because that was a way to get around the British problem, the British veto.
Certainly.
Okay, so anyway, let's get back to NGEU, Next Generation EU. Now, what kind of spending priorities are in this new fiscal instrument? Where's the money going, and what is it intended to achieve?
So there's a lot in the recovery plan. There's many policy and economic priorities, but they essentially revolve around two main objectives, and that is, on the one hand, the green transition, and on the other hand, the digital transition. So those are really the two main overarching objectives which structure the whole package. So that certainly also marks a shift in terms of policy priorities, in terms of overarching paradigms vis-à-vis economic governance as it was being designed and implemented before the COVID-19 crisis. So that's what I can tell you in general.
It's just as you know, the normal budget of the European Union goes mostly to agriculture and cohesion funds, plus a number of smaller items like paying for salaries of people who work for the Commission and Horizon Europe and research funds, that kind of thing. And so does this represent a shift in spending priorities for the European Union?
Yes, I mean, it certainly marks a shift. And to a certain extent, NGU stands as a fully fledged macroeconomic and industrial agenda for the EU. So that's certainly one of the reasons why it's a paradigm shift in an instrument, in that it certainly embodies an embryo of autonomous EU economic and industrial policy, a clear, fully fledged plan about how we want European economies to evolve in the future. And that's certainly new. That scope and that level of ambition is certainly new when compared to how things worked before.
Do you think it's sufficiently connected to the crisis that it's intended to address? Is it a relevant kind of response to a pandemic?
It's my view is that it's certainly much, much wider than a focused response to a health crisis, which was COVID-19 at the outset. So certainly, NGU was a very also smart move from the EU institutions to use that pandemic as an opportunity to bring about a much wider and a much more ambitious program for European economies. It's about much more than the pandemic itself. It's about making European economies and making European societies fit for the future challenges of the country. The two main ones being the green transition on the one hand, the digital transition on the other hand. So it's not only about recovery. It's also about longer term resilience. Mm-hmm. So from that perspective, NGU certainly is a prime example of a good use of a crisis as an opportunity to set a path for the future.
Now, Paul, talking about NGEU, can you tell me what is your assessment? First of all, I have two questions. What's your assessment of the constitutional framework of NGEU, its legal basis, and whether or not that is sustainable? And then the next question would be, what is your assessment of the democratic governance of NGEU?
Yes. Yeah, so first of all, when it comes to the constitutional framework supporting NGEU, the plan primarily relies on two main legal bases and sources of power. On the one hand, that the plan relies on a little provision that's enshrined in the treaties, Article 122 of the Treaty on the Functioning of the European Union, which is a bit of the emergency clause of the treaties, which enable the EU to take measures to react to emergency situations. That's the first legal basis that was mobilized primarily to justify the funding, to justify the borrowing of the 750 billion euros on the markets in the name of the EU. The second legal basis that was used was Article 175, which is about cohesion policy. That's the main legal basis that supports the Recovery and Resilience Fund, which is the main channel through which the funds will be disbursed and transferred onto the member states. So an interesting point to make is that NGEU was very much brought about within the existing treaty framework, using existing legal basis. Of course, that makes sense. It was an emergency response. The member states were not going to start revising the treaties before having to react. And so the institutional lawyers in the EU institutions did what they had to do. They worked with the legal basis they had, and they came up with this very innovative, this very ambitious, and to a certain extent, far-stretched legal construction. Now, the problem is, of course, that they were very far in their interpretation of these legal basis. In one regard, in specific, they use emergency clauses. They use clauses for the cohesion policy to bring about this very structural initiative, which will have long-term impact on European economies, which will have long-term impact on the EU budget. So there's a bit of a mismatch between what the legal provisions were foreseen for and the kind of beast that they brought about. So from a strictly legal perspective, it might be all right, but then it's certainly not a template that can be replicated forever, and it's certainly not a sound basis for what some are currently considering, which is turning NGEU into a permanent feature of the EU and of its economic governance, making it a permanent fiscal capacity that we do not have the legal basis for. And any attempt to make NGEU permanent will, I believe, and maybe we'll talk about this a bit earlier when discussing the proposals of the conference, but I believe any attempt to make it permanent will require treaty revision and the creation of new, sounder legal basis and also more explicit legal basis about this. So that would be my reply for the first question.
Can I just ask a quick follow-up about that?
Yes, absolutely.
Is debt the problem, or is from a constitutional perspective? Because this, it's always been the practice, correct me if I'm wrong, it's always been the practice of the European Union to pay its budget year upon year without ever going into debt, right? And so this is for the first time, taboo has been broken and they're actually mutualized, there's going to be long-term mutualized debt. Now, does that present a problem from a constitutional perspective, or is it just a political problem that made it a taboo?
Well, certainly common knowledge before the pandemic was that the EU, as a matter of principle, was not able to run deficits and borrow on the markets. Now, the whole NGEU has been constructed in a way that there's no real deficit because the funds, the monies borrowed on the capital markets are already, from a very technical perspective, covered by future resources, which will need to be brought in by the member states, which will need to be levied in the EU. So that certainly was one of the trickiest aspects of the plan, one of the most divisive ones. Lawyers managed to find the legal packaging which made it legal. But it remains rather fragile from my perspective, and it's certainly not something that can be replicated again. But certainly that is part of the fragility, at least the legal fragility of the entire legal construction of next generation.
Right. And do you think, is it a Hamiltonian moment?
Oh, that's the $500 question. Yes and no. It's not a Hamiltonian moment because we're not talking about mutualizing pre-existing debt. We're talking about creating new debt. So that's a different kind of Hamiltonian moment. But nonetheless, it's a major moment because it's one of the first time that the EU will raise so much money in its own name. So using its collective credibility to go to the capital markets and raise monies in the EU's name. That's certainly new, and that's very significant from a political perspective. So that's a big moment, whether it is Hamiltonian or not. I leave that to the historians, but that's a big moment, at least from a political and from a legal perspective.
Right. Okay, so now let's talk about the question of the democratic governance of NGEU.
Yeah, so turning to the issue of the governance of the fund and of the recovery program, there I see a lot of continuity with the way economic governance was being managed and carried out in the past. So the system we inherited primarily from the Eurozone crisis and the sovereign debt crisis was a highly executive dominated system. At EU level, clearly the Commission and the Council were in the driving seat, and the European Parliament was largely left out of the various processes and mechanisms that constituted economic governance, whether it's the European semester, whether it's financial assistance via the ESM. All these mechanisms were very much executive dominated and also largely intergovernmental in a way. And from this perspective, NGEU does not represent a shift. So the way the plan is managed, the way NGEU is being implemented, is still very much dominated by executive institutions. So it's still very much the Commission that is in the driving seat, bilaterally negotiating the plans with the member states, then overseeing the implementation of those plans and releasing the money. Of course, it's doing this in tandem with the Council. The Council has a big say in the final approval of the plan, in the decisions to release the tranches of the funding. So that executive dominance is still very much there. The Parliament has done all it could to have a bigger say in the actual management of the fund. It has secured certain victories, but overall, this parliamentary sidelining that we witnessed after the Eurozone crisis is still very much there. I mean, we have this recovery and resilience dialogue when commissioners and representatives of the Council come to the Parliament to discuss the plan, discuss their orientations, their effective implementation. But it remains a dialogue. Decision making is still very much located within the executive fora of the EU, and to a very large extent, of course, it depends from one member state to the other. But that executive dominance can also be observed at the national level when it comes to the design of the plan, their implementations. Well, it's still very much in the hands of governments, and governments remain the main interlocutors of the EU when it comes to the implementation of the plan. Maybe one major difference when it comes to democratic governance has not to do with the implementation of the plan. The implementation of the plan is, as I just said, very much dominated by executive institutions. But then the adoption of the plan, and that's interesting, it all occurred within the EU legal order. So according to the traditional community methods. So here the European Parliament had a big say on the adoption of the regulation on the recovery and resilience funds, on the adoption of various conditionality regulations. And that's the shift, that's the difference. Because in the aftermath of the Eurozone crisis, we saw that a lot of important instruments had been adopted as separate treaties, whether it is the fiscal compact, the ESM treaty, with the Parliament being, of course, totally left out. Here with NGEU, when it comes to the adoption of the NGEU, we've witnessed a return to the EU legal framework and to the traditional community methods, where the Parliament, as a fully democratic institution, has a big say. But then when it comes to the implementation and the actual management of the plan, executive dominance is still very much there.
I understand completely. And I think, of course, Parliament is supposed to have the power of the purse. And if you compare the kind of the Eurozone governance regime prior to NGEU, that was all about surveillance. you know, constraints on national parliaments, but it wasn't about actually passing a budget through the European Union. It wasn't. It was about fiscal rules, applying fiscal rules to national governments and national parliaments. That put major constraints on what national parliaments could do. But it was not the European Parliament. It was less absurd that the European Parliament was not so involved, because it was about rules rather than about spending at the EU level. In any case, I work on national parliaments in the European Union. So I'm very interested in that point. Okay, let's turn to the Conference on the Future of Europe. These two things, the NGEU and the Conference on the Future of Europe, they happened to coincide with one another, though there isn't necessarily an organic connection between them. But the conference, because Conference on the Future of Europe was planned before the pandemic happened, and then it was actually postponed by the pandemic. But in any case, the Conference on the Future of Europe has finished. It's reached its conclusions, and it made a number of recommendations, and a number of recommendations specifically about economic governance. Now, do you want to talk about some of the recommendations of the conference, and are there some in particular that you would highlight and that you think deserve support?
Yeah, I believe what's really interesting when you look at the final proposals of the conference, and especially those devoted to economic governance, is that there's an overall support with what the EU has done in responding to the COVID-19 crisis. There's an overall support for NGEU as a policy instrument, support for what it stands for. And the first important proposal is that there seem to be a strong will to make these kind of instruments, to make these kind of fiscal capacity a permanent feature of the EU's toolbox. That's the first important thing. Citizens seem to be wanting such capacity to become a stable and permanent feature in the EU landscape. Secondly, there's also a strong emphasis on the need for public investment. And so this also supports the general direction which was taken with NGEU, heavy, intense public investment into future-oriented infrastructure, whether it is green or digital transition. And thirdly, and that struck me how strongly emphasized it was, there seemed to be a strong desire for a more socially oriented economic governance. So the proposals come back to that point in several regards, but there's a clear will for this more socially oriented economic governance focused around the structure and principles of the European pillar of social rights, so better employment conditions, better social policy, a more ambitious equality and non-discrimination policy. So I think these are, the three main takeaways that I make from the proposals, at the very least, when it comes to economic governance.
And do you think, will these proposals require treaty change?
Well, the first one, and we've already discussed it, when it comes to making NGEU permanent and endowing the EU with a permanent structured fiscal capacity, I don't see in the treaties the space for doing that. So the legal foundations of NGEU, which was a one-off crisis management instrument, are already relatively shaky, relatively fragile. Endowing the EU with a permanent fiscal capacity within the existing constitutional framework, I don't really see this happening. So I believe there you will need treaty change. Now, when it comes to the second category of recommendations about investment, there I believe that there's a wide margin of appreciation. You would of course need to amend the EU's fiscal policy rules, so the EU's rules about national budgetary policy, but that's fairly doable via legislative reforms, because you don't have much in the treaties. You have a few overarching principles, but then the details of the rules, the exemptions, the locus for expansion, you have them in legislation. So of course it will be tough nonetheless, but it's feasible within the existing treaty framework. And finally, when it comes to giving economic governance a more social orientation, there too, I believe there's a wide room for maneuver. So the various frameworks and mechanisms for economic governance can very much be changed from the inside to be made more socially oriented. And that's already been partially done with Next Generation EU. So the emphasis of Next Generation EU is on green and digital transition, but the pursuit of the principles and objectives of the European Pillar of Social Rights are also among the main transversal objectives that NGEU need to achieve. And also when it comes to social and employment policy, you already have plenty of legal basis in the treaties to pass reform. Of course, you need the political will to do so, but the competence bases are there. And so there's ample room for legislative reform in support of social rights, in support of workers, and in support of a better employment conditions. A prominent example of this is the recent deal that was reached between the Council and Parliament about the Minimum Wage Directive. It's a very ambitious instrument, which was which could be done within the existing. So there's many things we can do within the existing treaty framework when it comes to social and employment reforms.
And just a quick follow-up, the fiscal rules, there's enough flexibility that that you could suspend the fiscal rules without treaty change. I mean, they've already been suspended for a couple of years, right? Since the pandemic. But
So they've been indeed suspended already many times now. Since basically March 2020, they've been suspended. So the Stability and Growth Pact is on pause. And every 6 months, the Commission extends the suspension to a point, in my view, where the very relevance and the very existence of these rules is put into question. Now, I said, indeed, there's a lot of flexibility within the treaties when it comes to fiscal policy rules. But the very idea of fiscal policy rules is enshrined in the treaties. So if you would decide to totally abandon the idea of debt and deficit limits, you would need to change the treaties. But within that framework, there's a lot of room. There's ample rule of maneuver. For example, to take out certain expenses, certain expenditures, certain investments out of the calculation of debt and deficit. That's certainly something that can be done. The level of stringency of the surveillance and of the supervision can very much be adjusted within the existing treaty framework via legislative reform. So there are certain red lines, indeed. I mean, the 3% debt rule, the 60% debt rules, I mean, they're there, they're in the treaties. The idea of fiscal policy rules is very much enshrined in the treaties. But then within these few red lines, there's ample room. And we can certainly expect reform proposals in the coming months. The Commission is very hardly working about this. Whether it will be ambitious enough, that's another thing. But things will move in that regard. That's for sure.
And so even though there's no organic connection between the Conference on the Future of Europe and NGEU, they could end up supporting one another. The conference has come out in support of instruments like NGEU and making them permanent.
Yeah, I believe. When I read the document, when I read the proposals, I mean, one of the underlying messages is certainly that citizens are very much in support of the general direction that the EU has taken with NGEU. Of course, they would like the EU to go deeper. But at least when it comes of the general direction, there's a citizen support for that. Yes, that's the way I read it.
Okay, well, that's a fascinating perspective that you've given us on Next Generation EU and the recommendations of the Conference on the Future of Europe. And I've got my eye on the clock, and I'm aware that we don't have that much time left. But I'd really like to hear you talk about your new book, which is coming out in a couple of months, I believe. Could you give us the elevator pitch for your book, and what's your main argument, and what's it, what kind of a contribution does it make to the existing literature?
Yeah, so the focus on the book is on economic governance in the Eurozone and in the EU more generally. The book is based on the PhD I started writing in 2016, and it was finalized before COVID hit, but then I actualized it and I implemented the latest evolution in the book itself. So the book essentially tries to do two things. First of all, it tries to make sense of all these many reforms that were passed in the area of economic and fiscal governance over the past decade as a reaction first to the Eurozone crisis, then to the COVID-19 crisis, and to see how it has shaped and changed economic governance. And in that regard, I find that the face of economic governance has changed dramatically. And we now see a new governance system, which is much more centralized, which is much more strong and intrusive, and which truly enables the EU to dramatically shape, but also constrain economic and fiscal choices made at the national level. So there's been a great intensification of the EU's intervention in the realm of economic and fiscal policy. It was already the case in the aftermath of the Eurozone crisis and COVID, and NGEU to a large extent have further exacerbated that trend. So that's the first part of the book. The first part of the book tries to make sense of how economic governance has evolved and how it has changed over the past decade. Then the second part of the book seeks to take stock of the legal and the constitutional guarantees that that system of governance offers in terms of respect for the competences of the EU and respect for the power allocation system that is in force in the EU, in terms of access to justice and the possibility for citizens to challenge the measures that are passed by the EU in the economic and fiscal field, and also in terms of fundamental rights protection, because obviously the action of the EU and the economic and fiscal fields has dramatic repercussions on the ground. And so the book seeks to make sense of how economic governance is or is not supported by sufficiently strong legal and constitutional guarantees from these various perspectives. And the overall finding that the book makes is that there's currently a bit of a mismatch between the way the powers of the EU in the fiscal and economic field have evolved and the strength of the legal and constitutional guarantees that this new system of governance offers. So there are currently gaps in terms of judicial protections, gaps in terms of political representations, gaps in terms of fundamental rights protection. So there's a mismatch. There are gaps that need to be filled because they are highly problematic from a legal and a constitutional perspective. So that would be in 2 minutes the core arguments that the book tries to make.
Yes, and I'm very much looking forward to reading the book. It's not out yet, but I did read the conclusion that you sent me, and I was fascinated by it. It's always struck me that there's something very elusive about the kind of the rules of economic governance as they evolved. And you describe it to some extent as soft law. And so your book, which is a rule of law perspective on this, is, you know, rule of law is all about legal certainty, right? And so from a purely rule of law perspective, some of the rules, which are kind of soft, of this economic governance regime are problematic, basically. That's kind of your diagnosis of the problem.
Yes, it's part of the diagnosis that I'm trying to make. I'm also trying to question the role that legal rules play in the overall functioning of the economic and monetary union. And here I make several kinds of findings, but one of the main ones is certainly that there's a bit of a manipulation of the law. There's a bit of an instrumentalization of the law. And so one of the core arguments of the book is that the law needs to be given a more central position, or at least constitutional law needs to be given more credibility and more credit, and needs to be more central in the operationalization of the EU.
And what is your perspective on these kind of these legal instruments that were brought into being to address the crisis that are actually outside of the EU treaties framework? Should they be brought into the framework of the EU treaties, like the European Stability Mechanism, the Fiscal Compact Treaty, this kind of bricolage legal instruments? Are you critical of that as a response to the crisis?
Yeah, I mean, certainly. I mean, and it's a point I made before. To a certain extent, NGU has handed that trend of going outside, right? Concluding separate treaties outside the EU. At some point, it was considered to establish NGU the same way the ESM had been established as an instrument outside the EU. Hopefully, that did not happen. And NGU marked a certain return to the traditional community method and the EU legal framework. And that's a good thing, because indeed, this trend that we witnessed during the Eurozone crisis with the ESM treaty, with the fiscal compact, was a problematic trend. Maybe it was comprehensible from a political perspective, because it was a much faster and potentially politically easier way to do things. But then from other legal or political perspective, it was highly problematic. But we've inherited from some of these instruments, and they're still there. I mean, the ESM still exists. It's still a separate international organization, not enshrined in the EU legal framework. There's been attempts to bring it back within the EU institutional framework, but so far it has failed. So we'll need to see. But speaking as a lawyer, and more specifically speaking as a constitutional lawyer, I believe that these instruments and this trend of going outside is highly problematic in terms of legal and political accountability, in terms of fundamental rights protection, in terms of political decision making. So it's certainly not something to be replicated in the future, and it's also something to be corrected. So hopefully we'll find a way to bring those things back into the EU framework.
I mean, I think there's a narrative, like there's a story that the EU tells itself about the financial crisis, the Eurozone crisis, that the crisis hit, and then there was a bit of flailing around, but then Mario Monti made his whatever it takes speech, and then there were various legal responses, and then eventually Europe muddled through. I think that's a common perspective of how the financial crisis was eventually solved. Do you take issue with that kind of standard narrative of the financial crisis? And do you think that ultimately the European Union successfully managed the crisis and saw a way out of, and actually finally found a way out of the crisis?
Yeah, I mean, this muddling through narrative, I totally buy it. That's how the EU reacted. And it's also a bit in sharp contrast with what happened with COVID and NGU. NGU was a much more direct and far-reaching response. So this kind of incrementalism that we saw with the financial crisis was not replicated with NGU, and that was a good thing. Coming to your second point, whether the answer to the crisis, more specifically to the Eurozone crisis, was a success. Well, I mean, the euro is still there. The Eurozone did not collapse. We managed to stick together. So from that perspective, I mean, the integrity of the single currency was preserved. So that's already a success. But then at what cost, at what political cost, at what human cost was it achieved? that's another story. And certainly, a lot of mistakes have been done. A lot of things could have been done better. So it's a partial success, I would say, or a costly success.
What you said about COVID-19, about how the approach was completely different, and the reaction of the European Union was much more robust. Do you think that there's maybe been a cultural change at the center? Because if you look at the reaction to the war in Ukraine, that resembles more the reaction to COVID-19 than it does to the muddling through of the decade that preceded COVID-19.
Yeah, I mean, I believe definitely the EU, as any polity, learns from its past experiences and from its past mistakes. So, to a certain extent, the EU learns how to act as an actual power. And here I totally agree with, for example, the views of Luc van Middelaar about the politics of rules, which is what the EU is historically used to, and the politics of events, the politics of crisis. And more the EU learns to speak the language of events and crisis politics. And certainly COVID, and even more now Ukraine, show us that the EU is more and more used to speaking the language of power and able to react quickly and in a meaningful way to acute political, economic, or health stresses.
I mean, I would note that one of the speakers at yesterday's event, Neil Richmond, he said that the tenor of the Conference on the Future of Europe changed after the war started. Like people were galvanized by it, so that even affected how the deliberations went in the conference. So it's an interesting you can see how it affects the views of citizens as well, and not just the institutions. Well, Paul, I think that we've had a fascinating discussion here. I think I'm looking at the time, and I think we've basically run out of time. So there's nothing left for me to do but just to thank you for talking to me here today and to joining us on the Amplify podcast.
Thanks a lot, Jan, for the invitation. And it was a great pleasure to exchange with you on these very important and interesting topics.
You have been listening to Amplify, which is made with the support of the European Union's Erasmus Plus program and the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe initiative, although these institutions do not necessarily endorse its contents. It is produced by the DCU Brexit Institute in association with the Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence Rebuild. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Andre Woolgar. Thank you for listening.